You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The Human Genome Project released the first full sequence of a complete human gene 20 years ago. And along with the project came the potential for a new kind of medical treatment called personal medicine or precision medicine. The hope was that we could have unique treatments tailored to our genetic profiles. That hope came with a lot of hype. But our guest says, in reality, genetic differences have proven to be small factors in a lot of major illnesses, things like asthma or Parkinson's. And when personalized medicine has been effective, the cost for treatment can be ruinous for patients. But he says there's an even deeper problem. Funding has gone toward this kind of genetic medicine research and away from environmental causes of disease that could lead to more cost-effective prevention efforts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you familiar with this idea of personalized or precision medicine? Have you or someone you know or loved one had one of these treatments? Was it effective? Was it expensive? Do you have questions about the hopes for this medicine and what we might have lost in pursuing it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Tabry is a professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
I laid out the basics of the initial hopes for personalized medicine or precision medicine. Can you talk a little more about what we meant by those phrases at the outset?
Yeah, you nailed it. You know, the personalized medicine motto is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. And it's really intentionally designed to be a contrast with what's often chided as the traditional one-size-fits-all approach to medicine. And so the idea is, on traditional medicine, you know, if two patients have diabetes or if 1,000 patients have diabetes, they're all treated the same. But when we take the genomic differences between us into consideration, then that will no longer be the case. One patient with diabetes will get one treatment plan based on their particular genetic profile. Another patient will get a different one. And the promise there, the vision was that personalization, that ability to get down to the precise causes of problems, was going to just sort of be a revolution across healthcare.
We'll get into some of the problems with the way that came out, but a really fundamental story in your book is your concern that this quest for these personalized medicines, these genomics-based medicines, took away from research into environmental health. Literally, at one point, basically two different pieces of research pitted against each other at the federal level. Can you talk about that aspect of the threat to public health that you see in personalized medicine?
Yeah, the thread that runs through the whole book is the story about two efforts that were undertaken at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. That's really the agency that's the crown jewel of biomedical research for the United States. And after the Human Genome Project wrapped up in 2003, there were two different efforts to try to launch a nationwide study of health in America. One of those was called the National Children's Study, and that was going to be an effort to recruit 100,000 children from across the United States. One of the first recruitment centers was actually going to be focused on Waukesha County in Wisconsin. It was very much going to be focused on the environmental contributions to health and illness, and basically tracking children from before they were born until they were adults, collecting all this information about the environmental exposures that they had, and then looking for how that contributed to who got sick and who didn't later in life. The other effort was, again, focused on collecting data from people all over the United States. That was going to be focused much more on genetic contributions to health and illness, getting blood, getting some basic measurements from folks at the beginning, and then just sort of looking to see who gets sick later in life and then hook up those genetic differences with the differences in health outcomes. And they were really in a kind of competition to see who was going to come to life. We can sort of dive into the details as much as you want later, but the long story short was in December 2014, the National Children's Study was ultimately terminated. And in January 2015, a month later, President Obama announced in his State of the Union address what came to be called the All of Us Research Project, and that was that genomics effort. So the book sort of looks at what were the factors, the financial factors, the social factors, the scientific factors, the technological factors that inclined the National Institutes of Health to lean in the direction of this genomic study rather than the environmental one. And the argument of the book is that these are forces that are all across the United States. And so, in fact, we're seeing something, a pivot towards genetics and healthcare generally.
Talking to James Tabry about his new book, The Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Will joins us now in Oconomowoc. Will, hi.
Hey there. My dad had prostate cancer and it metastasized to his liver. When that happened, they started personalizing his treatment based on his genetics, and I don't know very much about it. I experienced it as he was experiencing it, and he in the end passed away. So I don't know if it helped him or if it just prolonged kind of a downward spiral. But I'm really interested in the topic. Thanks.
And Will, actually, before I let you go, first, I'm sorry for the loss of your dad. Do you know, do you have any sense of how much it cost along the way, or were those things covered?
Cost was immense. I'm from California, and the state picked up a large portion of the bill because he's an older man. He passed away at 79, and he was retired, and I'm sure that his bills were a lot.
Will, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know you can relate. You start your book with the story of your own father in Personalized Medicine.
Yeah, thanks so much for that call, Will. I had the exact same thought, Rob. The introductory chapter is basically my experience with this, and it was very similar to what Will just said, which was I encountered it by way of my father's experience with cancer. He was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in 2011. He was given a drug, one of the early drugs that were really hailed as kind of one of these breakthrough treatments in personalized medicine. It was a drug called Tarceva for patients with lung cancer. For every indication, he did live a longer life. The life expectancy for somebody with stage 4 lung cancer at that time was about 8 months. My father was on Tarceva. He lived for about 13 months. So, as Will said, it was a lot of money. It did not cure him. It probably kept him around for a little while longer. In the end, I wish he didn't have lung cancer. And the story about the prevention of lung cancer is not one about the genes in our bodies. It's about making the air that we breathe more lung friendly, whether that's with smoking cessation programs or radon remission programs or asbestos abatement programs. The real progress in the downward trend of lung cancer diagnoses over the last few decades has not been genomic medicine. It's about making the environments that we live in much, much healthier.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Jim, some conditions that I think we had hopes for early on in genomic research were very common and growing problems like asthma and Parkinson's disease. As researchers tried to find genetic ties to those particular widespread conditions, what did they find?
That the genetics were far more complicated than they anticipated. I think it's helpful to contrast it. There certainly are conditions which are largely genetic in nature. There's a number of rare disorders, thinking about things like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, sickle cell, where the genetic cause of the problem, the basic mechanisms responsible for it, have long been known. Those have lent themselves to genetic interventions, and we can talk about that later. It creates different problems of economics, but at least the biological plausibility is there. When you shift to the conditions that are taking the largest toll on most people, you mentioned asthma, Parkinson's, diabetes, heart disease, a variety of cancers. Those things are, from a genetic perspective, enormously complicated. There's not just one or a handful of genes. In many cases, there's tens, dozens, hundreds, even thousands of regions in the genome that are implicated in those conditions, along with all sorts of environmental contributions. And so what happens with those far more complicated traits is it just becomes that much more difficult to get any sort of purchase that you could then use to develop some sort of personalized medicine. And in turn, the progress on those fronts has been far more limited than in contrast to things like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell disease.
So in the conclusion for your book, I think you're making the case pretty strongly that if we want to tackle something like asthma, probably funding gene research isn't going to help. What would you like to see targeted instead?
We're going to get the most bang for our buck out of making the environments that we live in safer. And that's both doing the research that identifies the things that are making us sick. It's also, you know, and that's kind of traditional environmental research. Think of sort of, you know, focus on toxins, air quality, which population of kids have access to what air. You know, there's all sorts of research about different communities getting exposed to different environmental toxins. And so that's a part of that as well. The other side of it, of course, there was also social behavioral research and research about intervention. So even though we know, you know, in a city like Salt Lake City, where I live, the air quality is often very, very bad. But there's a big jump from recognizing that bad air quality is associated with a spike in asthma admittances into the hospital and coming up with interventions that can then alter that problem. And so I think, you know, the focus has to be on making the environment safer and developing the resource so that we can navigate an environment that isn't always safe.
We're talking to Professor James Tabry from the University of Utah about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest based on what you've heard so far? What do you think about the idea of healthcare shifting to look more at our genetic profiles, moving away from environmental factors? Would you like to reverse that, as our guest would? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to James Tabry from the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the idea of personalized medicine, environmental public health efforts that may have been funded less because of the focus on genes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jim, you mentioned earlier there are success stories where, yes, we're able to develop medications that work for people with more easily identifiable genetic causes of their conditions. But the costs, you write about that. Not only are they expensive to begin with, unlike a lot of medications, they seem to go up over time.
That's exactly right, Rob. The sort of poster child of personalized medicine was a drug called Gleevec. And it became the poster child in part because it was so successful and it came out quite early. So this was a drug that was approved by the FDA in 2001. That's right when the Human Genome Project is wrapping up. And so folks looking for, you know, something to point to as an example of this personalized medicine working were naturally drawn to Gleevec. It was a treatment for a particular form of blood cancer, for chronic myelogenous leukemia. About 5,000 to 10,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with it a year. And prior to 2001, life expectancy was quite poor. The chances of living more than 5 years after that diagnosis was very low. Now, when patients are diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, they can live for 10 or more years easily. And it's in part because of drugs like Gleevec and a series of others that have come along after it that are very effective at treating this cancer. But it came at a cost and in really frightening ways. When the drug was first approved, it cost about $2,000 to $3,000 a month. And so we're talking about $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And what happened was Novartis, the drug company that manufactured the drug, in the ensuing years, rather than having those costs come down as more and more patients were able to take it, and then in turn as more competitors came online to offer drugs that work similarly, the cost of it kept going up. And in fact, by the time that generics for Gleevec were finally available in 2016, the price of that drug had gone from about $20,000 to $30,000 a year to close to $150,000 a year. And there was this outcry from the chronic myelogenous leukemia patients and their families, as well as the researchers, saying that this is just unsustainable. And in fact, what we find is when you look across the board for these medications that are developed in this manner, they are oftentimes extremely expensive, sometimes in the millions of dollars, which creates all sort of access problems for the people who need it most.
Let's go back to our callers with Will in Madison. Will, hello.
Hi, hello. I have something that's concerning, connected to genetic research. Yes, I would like to participate in the genetic research of all of us knowing about it. However, I have not participated particularly in the genetic research because I have two parents who both had Alzheimer's and passed mm-hmm. with it. And my concern then is, what if that if I were to participate and that information were then exposed? Here is information potentially about me, and then it's made public. What does that do to my health care costs? What does that do to my insurance? Well, you know, this is very concerning. Once we get into genetics, if this may potentially be my future.
Well, thanks for the call. Jim, what do you think?
That's a great question, Will, and thanks for being willing to share it. I think the first thing to say is back in 2008, the federal government did pass something called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And so at least legally in theory, you cannot be discriminated against based on that genetic information when it comes to things like employment, housing, and health insurance. Now, there's sort of mixed reviews out there about how successful this is at protecting the people that need to be protected. But at least, again, in theory, the thought was we don't want people to be discriminated against based on that information. I think, though, the point that Will raises is a really important one, particularly with regards to a terribly scary condition like Alzheimer's disease. You know, the vision at the end of the Human Genome Project was, we're going to find the genes for these traits. We're going to then know the cause of them. And then that's going to pave the way for all sorts of biomedical interventions to make these problems go away so that we don't have to face those scary realities that some patients may be facing. Alzheimer's disease is just a classic example of one where there are some genes that are known to increase the risk of having it. But treatments for it have largely been wanting. You know, there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease yet. And so we are at a really awkward place now with some of these traits where genetic sources of the problems have been found, but then interventions that are supposed to make them go away are not available. And that creates the kind of problem that Will was just describing, where you might find yourself in a situation where you're torn about whether or not to get this information, because it's not like getting it will necessarily pave the way to a solution. It's just sort of creates the opportunity for all sorts of anxiety about the fact that you could have this thing and not have an obvious route towards preventing it.
Thanks for the call, Will. Talking to James Tabry about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Let's go now to Tom in Milwaukee. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering if one could extend the question of looking at environmental factors into aspects of political decisions, such as during the Trump administration, a lot of the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations were nullified, or protections for OSHA, for workers. These are political decisions. It's not necessarily a question of where to direct research so much as just maintaining the protections we should already have.
Tom, thanks for the call. Jim, you tackle that in the book. Point out, as Tom does, there's bipartisan disagreement over things like environmental protections and workplace safety. But this personalized medicine, people across the aisle seem to be able to work together on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm so glad that Tom raised that. You know, the subtitle of the book is Personalized Medicine, Its Threat to Public Health. I think that, you know, one of the points I want to make clear is I don't think there's anything necessarily intrinsic to this genomic medicine that threatens public health. Rather, the idea is that there are all these sort of forces at play that are blowing into the wind of the sails of personalized medicine, which simultaneously tend to work against focus on researching public health. And the political landscape that Tom brought up is a perfect example of that. When you look at focusing on the environment and environmental research generally, environmental health, the environmental contributions to health and illness, it is a very politicized phenomenon, right? I mean, you've got one political party where people that are trying to run for president are vowing to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, that's sort of how politicized it's become. And so it's a hot button issue. When you switch over to personalized medicine, genomic medicine, precision medicine, blue, red, you name it, across the political spectrum, political leaders love the idea of launching an initiative where they're promising to cure cancer or make kids with rare diseases live longer lives. It's one of those things that in our very polarized day and age is a place where Democrats and Republicans tend to unite. And so that's another one of these reasons that you can see all this attention and effort going into it, is because it's a spot where the political tension just isn't as fraught as it is on the environmental side.
Tom, thanks for that call. And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's James Tabry, professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health, Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. Talk to him today about his new book. It's called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol is a big part of Wisconsin culture and a major health hazard here in the state. We'll find out why Wisconsin stands out among states for high rates of drinking and of alcohol-related injuries, illnesses, and deaths. You can join already with your thoughts right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Why do you think Wisconsin has such a strong alcohol culture? If you've moved here from another place, what stood out to you? Do you have solutions in mind? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, a new documentary highlights endometriosis, a painful condition that often goes undiagnosed for the women dealing with it. We'll meet the filmmaker behind the project and also talk to a medical expert here in the state. And as always, you can join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a photographer whose new collection tells the story of life in rural Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes to understand the place you come from, you have to leave for a while. That's what our next guest did. Returning to rural Wisconsin after time away, she turned her camera to a familiar landscape and saw it in a new way. She shares the results in her new book. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a rural area? Did you move away? What is it like when you go back to visit? Do you try to capture images, whether it's with a camera or painting or drawing? What do you set your eyes on when you try to convey the idea of living in the rural Midwest? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Erin Springer is a photographer based in Menominee, Wisconsin and Brooklyn, New York. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. Her new photo book called Dormant Season was published last month. It will be more widely available in October. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, can you set the scene for us? Tell us about the landscape, the community you set out to take pictures in by Menominee.
Yeah, so I grew up outside of Menominee. I went to elementary through high school in Colfax, actually. And I moved away in 2011 and went to school in New York City for college. And then, like you said, after living away for a while, about 10 years, I just became increasingly interested and compelled to go home and make some photos. And I started making the work really during the Thanksgiving holiday, when my family would come home to do deer hunting and get together. That was kind of our big holiday. So the first photos in the project really came from that period with them. And then it sort of just sparked into kind of its own life and its own world. And I was really fascinated by the way that we could translate emotions by photographing the landscape and people and combining the two. And that's a big part of the book.
And there you are back in, you know, rural Wisconsin outside of Menominee there after spending time in New York City. You were there. You were looking at the scenery. I think it was COVID, the midst of the pandemic. What felt different to you being there and turning your camera on this place that had once been so familiar to you?
Well, I think it still felt very familiar. I think I just had a bit different perspective. I think that, I grew up with a very typical rural upbringing, but in contrast to the urban life that I was sort of living as an adult through my 20s, I sort of realized that living rurally was quite unique, or it can be quite unique, and also seen sort of from an insider, outsider perspective. Because I remember when I first moved away and I'd come home, it was just kind of every day. It didn't really strike me as, these interesting sort of scenes of, my aunt's, cow roaming around the farmyard or whatever these typical scenes might be. But the more time that I spent away, just the more I saw them from, I guess, for their unique value in a way that I hadn't really realized when I was living there, when I was much younger. I don't know. I can't say anything necessarily felt different. I just sort of had a different perspective. And I think I just had grown a lot as a creative person and an artist and was able to sort of translate those thoughts and that realization kind of in a unique way, or sort of distill it through photography.
And when I see art portraying rural life, I think oftentimes it's like, nostalgic. And sometimes it's sort of in the American Gothic, looking at it from a city perspective. I don't see either of those here. I feel like you're showing us life there. Could you talk about how you tried to, it seems like to me anyway, you kind of avoided both of those.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess it wasn't sort of conscious, in trying to avoid one thing or the other. I think my interest in photography stems from documentary work. And I was, as objective as I try to be about certain situations or the way I'm looking at things, I very much feel that my emotions are present and also just a huge part of what translates into the photos and how I feel and look at things. I guess there's not a whole lot of sentimentality or nostalgia, but I think that's inherent almost in a way to every photograph, because it's sort of this external memory and looking at the past, even if it was yesterday, or 5, 10, 20 years ago. But I think I just was really interested in sort of capturing the atmosphere that I felt when I went home, the starkness of the landscape, the way that people interact with it, and sort of the warmth that's present amongst such a cold period, literally the dormant season or the dormant period of the year. I found that tension to be really, really interesting. And I think probably too, just with the edit and the way that it's all put together, it kind of removes you from that sort of nostalgic perspective and gives you more of a maybe straightforward look at it. As much as the emotions are involved and present in it, I think it's a little bit more straightforward than sentimental.
Talking to Erin Springer, photographer. Her new book is Dormant Season, which includes photos from her hometown, her home community, just outside of Menominee here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Some of your photos are landscapes, some involve animals, but there are human subjects in them. And I understand some of them are relatives, some of them are not. How was it working with family and community members here?
Yeah. So the work started with my immediate family. I was making the photos initially when I would be home for Thanksgiving. And that was sort of just this, there wasn't real specific intention. That's the way I've always sort of interacted and participated in different family events. And I've always been just really compelled to capture the moments with my family. But then this work started growing into something that I felt was much bigger and should and could be expanded into the community. And, the more time I spent with my family in sort of familiar settings, the more curious I was about foreign settings, even if it was just, neighbors next door. You don't really realize how many times you might drive by a farm or see somebody in a town nearby that you don't know. And, without approaching them or literally knocking on their door, you may never know about them or their life. And I really, I learned a lot from people that I would approach sort of at random. And it's definitely different challenges working with family versus community, strangers, but You know, I really, everybody that's in this work, I've developed a personal relationship with that I think will kind of carry out, you know, carry on throughout my life. So I feel really, really fortunate for everybody that had their open doors to me. But yeah, it's just amazing, like how many different situations you can get in when you just let your curiosity sort of steer the way and follow your instincts and approach people. And, you know, most often people are open and curious as well. You know, even if they're not not familiar with the type of photography that I was interested in making, we had that sort of mutual interest in each other and what I was trying to do, and for me, you know, how they were living and who they are. So yeah, it worked out really well. I feel really fortunate to have worked with the people that I did and encountered in very unexpected ways.
I want to visit a couple of the photos here, and I'm looking at one right now. And this is selfish. I didn't grow up on the family farm. Grew up visiting my great uncle's family farm. Fond memories of time in the hayloft. And you've got a picture, a bunch of kids. It's almost set up like an amphitheater in the hayloft there. Can you tell us a little bit about that image?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess to describe the picture a bit. So there's this, the group of kids are hanging out in the hayloft, which is the upper level of a barn, for anybody that might not be familiar. And there's two boys hanging from the rafters, and there's other kids and a cat seated on top of some stacked hay bales. And they're all talking amongst themselves. Nobody's making direct eye contact. And we're sort of just enveloped by this, yeah, amphitheater, like you said. Or when I first saw that scene, I thought, wow, this is like a cathedral. You know, the light is streaming in, and, you know, the light's reflected from the particles in the hay and the air. So yeah, I got to this image. It actually was a pretty long buildup to this, because I was with my uncle and my cousin, who were loading soybeans at this farm, just a year prior. And I'd always driven, this is kind of the perfect classic example of what I was saying earlier, where I was always driving by this farm and I knew of the family that lived there, but I'd never actually been to the farm. So I went with my uncle and my cousin, and just to spend time with them. And there was a bunch of kids running around the farmyard, and, you know, just struck up conversation with one of the teenagers. And I learned that there's a one room school there, with 15 or so kids, ages 6 to about 17. So every grade. And, you know, within that conversation, I talked to the farmer that lives there, and his daughter has the school. And he told me that it was actually my great, great, great grandfather that built that barn. So I just thought, wow, like this is so, how, you know, the things you learn just by asking a few questions. And, you know, this was only 5 miles from where I grew up, but I hadn't known that prior to that visit. So I sort of took that as a sign, and I started spending time at the school the following year. I was really thinking about this, you know, I think I was on my way back to New York when I first met the kids at the school, and I was there on that initial visit with my uncle. But yeah, I really just kind of took this as a sign, and I was so curious about this. I just really wanted to explore what the school was like too. Just like the fact that there was kids learning on a school was, or sorry, learning on a farm was really interesting. So yeah, then I just went back the following fall and spent a lot of time with the kids, and that photo was made on their sort of recess lunch break. It was cold outside, and they spend time in the barn and play with the kitties, and that was sort of where they congregate. And yeah, we just had a lot of fun, and I made that picture of them, and just really, yeah, it was a really special experience for me. And I really am really glad for that moment in that photo.
We're talking to photographer Erin Springer about her new book. It's called Dormant Season, which captures life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you see beauty in rural Wisconsin life? The people, the places, the buildings, the landscapes. Do you try to capture those through photos or drawing or painting or writing? Do you have a favorite artist who portrays what life is like in the rural Midwest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with photographer Erin Springer about her new book, Dormant Season, a collection of photos of life in rural Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you try to catch images of rural Wisconsin on camera or painting or drawing or whatever you might do. Love to hear from you what you like to draw. Join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce in Two Harbors, Minnesota, who said, aside from loving living in a rural part of his state, he thinks the windmill is a great icon of rural landscape. I don't think you have windmills, Erin, but something that really kind of looms over the scenery a lot is the silo. I see that showing up in a few pictures, and that gives, I don't know, it gives like a height to some of the pictures. Can you talk about how you tried to bring silos into the, I'm looking at one right now, actually, with some birds doing a flyby.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really, I hadn't intentionally sort of thought about the incorporation of silos, but maybe there's a subconscious thread there of sort of the storage of memory. Maybe there's something there about, you know, the storage of crops that go into silos throughout the winter. And sort of this project is a sort of container of my memories and expression of my memories. Maybe that's a stretch, but if I had to give a top of mind answer, that might be something going on in my inner mind there.
I love it. We've got Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Well, hello, good afternoon. I've done the similar thing, moved away and came back. And what I found as I recall these memories, and I wanted to ask the artist here, as part of the creative process that goes into taking a photograph or a scene, does music play a part? Or even after you produce the photograph later, do certain songs remind you of certain scenes? Or as part of the creative process, how does music affect what you do?
Interesting question, Ooh. Jeff. Erin, what do you think?
Yeah, that is such an interesting question. I actually was listening to a song on repeat kind of while I was making this work, and I was really listening to a lot of classical music, a lot of piano and a lot of cello. And I spent so much time just driving around by myself in the landscape and the openness of the sort of winter fields and sky. And I found the classical music to be really, really helpful in sort of getting me into a zone of emotion and mood, and also kind of just creating a canvas for me to look at things without having words placed upon them. So the classical music I was listening to was all instrumental. And I thought that was really, it really was moving to me to, you know, watch snow drifting across the road, watching wind, watching just people from a distance while listening to music that has such big crescendos and everything. I thought it was really, really helpful for me, but I hadn't really thought about it as part of the process. I think it was sort of, again, just like a subconscious thing that I would do when I would think of it, and I would sort of need another spark, you know, to get me into a mindset to make photos or feel a certain type of way.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. I can't leave it hanging, Erin. What song were you listening to on repeat in particular?
I knew you were going to ask, and I need to, hold on. Let me pull this up here. Let's see. I've got I can never remember the name. It's one that I hadn't heard before I sort of put on a shuffle in classical music here. I've got a playlist. Sorry for the
here. Was it actually just building the suspense for me? I don't know about anybody else.
I know. Here it is. Okay. It's by Anya Lechner, and it's called Vague, and then it's / En la Naveva. And it's from her album Lontano.
All right, we're gonna get a link on our segment note for that. Erin, as we wrap up, just briefly, one thing that really strikes me, you put the photos in the book, you don't have captions, you don't have descriptions. What led to that decision, just letting those photos stand for themselves?
Well, I think it's important for viewers to have their own interpretation of the work. I think what you feel and what you glean from a body of visual work is as relevant as what maybe the artist did making it. And so I just really, the mystery of it and the openness and all the different forms that it can take on and the spaces that it can occupy in your mind, if you aren't overly explicative with things and you don't explain what's necessarily happening, I think can be really helpful for a visual project like this. You know, it's not specific to one person, one place, or even one story. It's really to evoke a feeling and convey sort of a more generalized mood. So I think that that's, I think not having captions and not having explanations is helpful for that.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing your work with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Springer, a photographer based in Menominee here in Wisconsin and Brooklyn, the New York kind of Brooklyn, not our Wisconsin Brooklyn. Her work has been featured in The New Yorker and The New York Times. She was with us to talk about her new photo book, Dormant Season, with lots of pictures of places, people, and landscape near Menominee. This summer, biologists in Wisconsin completed a years-long survey of the state's wood turtle population. The threatened species lives mostly in the North Woods. As Rob Metzer reports, wood turtles have been in decline as they lost their nests to predators and as humans poach turtles to sell illegally.
We're good?
It's a cool North Woods morning in May, and a group of about a dozen people are on a field trip sponsored by the nonprofit Natural Resources Foundation. The plan is to kayak down a river where scientists from the Department of Natural Resources are conducting a population survey of wood turtles. Andrew Badgie is a conservation biologist. On a car ride to the kayak launch, he says the wood turtle is in trouble.
A lot of the nesting habitat no longer is natural in the state, and so a lot of the wood turtles the females will actually nest along the roadsides. And that's just a really easy avenue for raccoons and other predators to dig up the nests.
Wisconsin classifies wood turtles as a threatened species. This year, the DNR shared its latest population survey data with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They'll decide whether or not wood turtles should qualify as a federally endangered species. That decision is expected next spring. These turtles have distinctive, lined markings, almost like the rings of a tree. Badgie says that's made them attractive to another predator. Poachers.
Where people will go into sites and basically collect as many wood turtles as they possibly can and sell them illegally across the seas in China and Southeast Asia and even in the United States and Europe.
In 2020, the Malaysian government extradited a Chinese citizen to the U.S. He was found to be running a multi-million dollar international turtle smuggling ring. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Badgie asked the WPR not give the exact location of the nesting sites to keep the information out of poachers' hands. The group paddles down the river, hoping to catch a glimpse of turtles sunning themselves. They stop at a shelter the DNR built to try to protect wood turtle nests from predators. Biologist Lena Carlson explains.
It's made out of wood. It's surrounded by chicken wire. However, at the very bottom, there is a gap, probably the size of a 2x4. Which is the exact height of a wood turtle. So only wood turtles can get in this box, and only wood turtles can get out of it.
Turtles are just coming out of hibernation in May. By June, they'll be looking for places to nest, and biologists hope they'll find these sites more attractive than the roadsides. Surveying the turtles is time-consuming and tricky. They don't just line up to be counted. There's a thunderstorm in the forecast today. Turtles can sense changes in barometric pressure, and they've made themselves scarce.
Do you want to check this one?
Sure.
A few weeks later, another biologist, Carly Lapin, is out surveying nest sites not far from that same river. This time, there's no group of tourists. She and a trainee dig out some nests so they can count the number of eggs before carefully replacing them. She says the threat to this species from the illegal pet trade is very real.
The females congregate in these like nesting areas every spring, so it's really easy for someone to just go and grab a bunch of female turtles, and they can wipe out a whole population, you know, in one night.
Lapin wears mosquito netting as we hike through swampy areas and along sandy roads where wood turtles like to nest. Deep in the woods, we spot one. The turtle is digging in the sand with her back legs. Lapin says she's just picking out her nest site.
So she's not nesting yet. She's digging a hole.
Lapin takes down some data about the turtle and the nesting site. Now that we've disturbed her, Lapin says this turtle will probably wait at least a few hours before laying her eggs. It's already illegal to hunt or take wood turtles from the wild. If the species is granted federally endangered status, that would mean more funding for research and conservation efforts like these. Scientists say that's needed to keep the wood turtle population from dwindling further. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find that story and lots more online at WPR.org, including the latest from the WPR News Department, stories from Wisconsin Life, and of course, audio archives for the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.